Here's to the finest crew in Starfleet.
Engage.
Captain Jean-Luc Picard, the U.S.
Commander Benjamin Sisko, the Federation Starbase, Deep Space Nine.
Welcome to The Greatest Generation. It's a Star Trek podcast from a couple of guys who are a little bit embarrassed to have a Star Trek podcast. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Franica.
The holidays are over. We had a long break from recording The Greatest Generation, but we're back.
Yeah.
An imperceptible break to the listeners, but
that's how we like it.
Yeah. I'm very proud of the fact that we always release an episode no matter what.
Perfect record so far.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
Over the last month or two, we've transitioned from a Seattle-based P.O. box, Adam, to a Los Angeles-based P.O. box. And I've given out the address to our Los Angeles-based P.O. box a few times. Definitely, people have sent in emails asking for it.
Yeah, where can people get it?
Just send an email to drunkshimoda@gmail.com. And if I notice your email, I will endeavor to get you that address.
That's really the first battle right there.
Yeah. Oh, and since you're going to be an Angelino soon, I've got a key for that P.O. box for you, Adam.
Wow. So far, the only key to anything in Los Angeles that I have at this moment in time.
Speaking of only things, we only have received one thing in the P.O. box that was actually meant for us. I think I got a Christmas card for its previous user, but
hey, that's nice.
There was no return address on it, so I felt bad because a return to sender isn't going to result in anything, but I also didn't want to open somebody else's mail. So
you're guessing that it was a Christmas card, or did you open it?
It was the form factor of a Christmas card, and it had a Christmas stamp on it. So
I would have opened that thing.
Really? See if there's like a $50 bill in there.
Do you still have it?
No, I put it back at the post office with no, not deliverable at this address written on it.
Wow, that would have been a great Marin. Us committing mail fraud on the show.
Do you want to do a Greatest Gen mailbag episode with one mailbag item?
God, I don't know if that's enough for a Marin, Ben. I mean, it's kind of rolling the dice.
It is, but we roll dice all the time. You know, we roll dice on Friendly Fire, we roll dice on Greatest Gen.
My interest in gambling is basically the main thing about me. So yeah, why not? Let's do it.
It's a wonder we're friends.
Captain, I'm sorry to disturb you.
I'm receiving a code 47.
Verify.
It is code 47, sir. Starfleet emergency frequency.
Captain's eyes only.
All right. This is from Matt L. in Bountiful, Utah.
Hmm. That sounds like a nice place.
It's one of these ready post mailers that I never know how to open. It sort of looks like there's a tab that I'm supposed to pull, but I can't get it. I can't get it!
More like difficult, Utah.
All right, there is a crumpled up letter here. Dear Adam, Ben, Rob, and John. Wow! This is to a lot of us. Please find the enclosed challenge coins from Utah Internet Crimes Against Children Task Force with all the gratitude I can give you for your shows Greatest Generation, Greatest Discovery, and Friendly Fire. You provide a wonderful respite from a difficult career. I often save one of your shows for running along the river path near my office on my lunch break. And it is the best part of my day. You bring me joy. And he says he went to the Denver live show last year and Austin this year. Oh, I think I remember meeting Matt L.
That show was very memorable for a totally other reason that we experienced in line. But I also definitely remember these people from the ICAC.
The challenge coin is really cool. It's about the size of like a silver dollar. It's not a great big giant one like our bloated-ass challenge coin.
I thought if for its association with children, it might look like a video arcade token.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're looking for ideas for challenge coins, you can have that one, guys.
We redesign ours every year, and there's no reason this agency couldn't do the same. I'm going to Janky and Laura you a couple of pictures of it.
Yeah, dude. Adam. Oh, look at that. Wow. Yeah, we spoke briefly to a couple of ICAC people, and wow, it seems like their job is awful hard, and it felt great to hear that we in any way could help their days go better.
Boy, touring last year, we met some people that really do tough things, like we met an interpreter who works in an asylum center, and that's like really, really challenging work right now, especially, and doing stuff like this is, I really admire people that are able to do work like this, because I certainly am not equal to that task.
There is no podcast that exists that could fix what would break in me doing that kind of work. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Matt, and everyone at your office for the great work that they do. And we have an assistant attorney general from the state of Utah on our side, in case anybody was wondering.
I often fly through the Salt Lake Airport these days, and should I ever be detained in a way that I deem wrongful...
Yeah,
I'll make sure to drop.
You've got
that
a name to drop.
Yeah,
he's gonna be like, I don't know this guy.
most people react that way when I drop their names.
Yeah. Thanks so much. And if you have something that you would like to send us to a physical address, please go ahead and reach out. It's drunkshimoda@gmail.com, and we'll I do my best to keep an eye on that inbox and send the address to people who request it. You know, not perfect. So if you don't hear back the first time, just try again. It's not personal. It's just that there are so many things coming into that inbox at all times that it's impossible to to reply to everything.
It's definitely been found by spammers too. So it's like an extra element of dig that's required.
Definitely. Well, Adam, do you want to get into the weird episode that we came here today to talk about?
I really do, right after what I am going to call a sufficient Marin. I think that was good. That's all the Marin we needed.
We occasionally really luxuriate in a long Marin.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there have been episodes where we go 20 minutes. That's too much.
Nobody wants that.
That's too many clicks of the forward 30 seconds.
That's what's called over marinating.
Yeah, sure is.
It's fun to do a podcast with somebody that doesn't think you're funny.
It's just an act, Ben. I think you're one of the funniest people. I only believe you're not funny for the show.
Oh, cool. Cool. All right, let's get into it. It's season 5, episode 24, Empaknor.
Do you realize how incredible this is? No, of course you don't.
I have the hardest time with the Nors. I always want to call them Noirs. And no one on the show seems to have that problem.
Yeah, well, you know, you're not supposed to use the word nor without the word neither appearing earlier in the sentence also.
Right.
So, should be neither Empok nor Cardassian or
something
like that.
I think you found it. You found my main problem is grammatical. You're right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not pronunciation whatsoever.
It's like the Ursula Le Guin rule of giving your space alien characters names is like they have to pass your mental spell check. They can't just be like an assembly of nonsense letters.
Yeah, that's what makes science fiction writing so difficult. It's coming up with names that are both sensical and nonsensical.
Right. Very challenging. I think they do a good job of that on Star Trek for the most part.
This is an episode that's a lot about mixing tone. And the tone that this episode starts with is the single brass instrument of drinking alone. It's Quark's bar. Morn is at the bar by himself, and the occasional sound of what could be like a spoon in a garbage disposal.
What was that?
Going off when Dax, Kira, and Worf walk in looking for a drink and an eat.
Fun industrial noise.
That's just my nephew, Chief O'Brien, repairing some conduit.
This happened to me and my wife just the other day. We went out for a hamburger sandwich for lunch at an outdoor eatery in Chinatown, in Los Angeles' Chinatown. And we ordered our burgers and we sat down at our picnic table and we're having a pleasant conversation, and just with comedic timing, our burgers were ready and a jackhammer started at the same moment.
That's great.
Yeah. It was like, I guess we're going to just wolf these down as fast as we can because this is intolerable.
Made me think a lot about sound design and science fiction, and specifically in Star Trek, because like the things that are meant to get your attention in Star Trek are the alert klaxons and the sound of laser fire or a torpedo or something. But when you get something that is like metal on metal like this, it really seems out of place in a way that gets your attention.
It's a sound that you don't experience on Star Trek very often at all. And I think that that's because so many of the solutions to problems are so high tech and so advanced. And this is kind of an illustration of the problem with this space station is they have Cardassian parts that they don't have access to the aftermarket for.
And it's weird, right? Because you hear that this is some sort of plasma conduit issue, like plasma manifold, I think is what O'Brien calls it later. But like, it sounds like a dryer full of coffee beans. Like, it's, like it sounds more mechanical than science-y.
It's enough to drive off Kira, Dax, and Worf, who decide to go to the Klingon restaurant.
How could that be any quieter, though?
I mean, I think that was the premise of the joke, right?
You get that guy singing at you the whole time. It's always your birthday at the Klingon restaurant, right?
Right, yeah. Worf gets a sombrero.
Yeah.
Put on his head.
The sombrero of Gach. Oh. That'd be so much fun.
That would be great.
I miss that guy. Terrible mistake for DS9 to have written that set and that character off the show.
Terrible mistake, and it seems like in this script they are admitting some regret.
Morn's ears look like belly buttons to me. Do you think the noise isn't an issue for him? Because he's not flinching at all when the sound happens, and he's perfectly content to be at the bar.
Morn has one place in the world that he wants to be, and he'll put up with almost anything to be there.
I'm envious of him.
It does seem nice.
I wish I had a place I wanted to be most in the world.
Yeah. Instead, it's just mild discomfort everywhere.
Yeah. It's not really living in a place.
Nog is assisting Chief O'Brien in these plasma ducts. And I was surprised that neither of them was wearing hearing protection, given this is like several walls away from where Quark's bar is, but it's very loud in Quark's bar.
Right.
You would think that Ferengis would have like really serious earplugs, given some of the capabilities their ears have been demonstrated to have.
Their over-the-ear ear protection has got to be, like, what, two frisbee golf discs?
I believe it's Frolf.
Right.
So as to avoid using the trademarked Whammo brand name for flying discs.
That would be how our show ends. A very protracted legal dispute with
a legacy toy company.
Yeah. And one not associated with Star Trek at all.
Yeah, you infringed our mark.
Yeah, crushed by Big Frisbee. That's how we go out.
Totally. So Chief O'Brien and Odo actually bring the problem with these plasma manifolds to Captain Sisko, who hears them out, and they explain like the only way to really fix this is to go get spare parts from this other identical space station that the Cardassians abandoned last year.
It's the same design as this station.
This is an episode in a series of episodes where a decision is brought to Captain Sisko that he makes, and then he exits the story completely for the next 45 minutes. Is Sisko being sidelined?
I don't know. You speculated on a recent episode that maybe American History X is shooting around this time.
Yeah.
So maybe he's getting breaks written into the scripts.
Yeah. I say this as someone who loves watching Avery Brooks work. Like, that's why I miss him.
Yeah.
But it also seems just exactly how a captain would be on a station like this.
Right.
Like,
this is not the kind of job that a captain goes and deals with. It's a 5-minute conversation he has one day and then never thinks about it again.
And most of his life has got to be like that.
Yeah, he's got to deal with that all the time.
Yeah.
He's not in the business of architectural salvage.
No.
You know who is? Garrick.
Lately, I've noticed everyone seems to trust me. It's quite unnerving. I'm still trying to get used to it.
Which is a great pairing. I like the idea of putting him with O'Brien. Their mission is to go to Empaknor, which is like a sister station to Terraknor. And this is a kind of science fiction that I love the most. Like, one of my favorite episodes of TNG was the Nagilim episode.
Yeah.
Where the Enterprise runs into itself.
It's the Yamato, our sister ship.
The Yamato's nowhere near the squadron.
And it feels haunted and strange. And there are many other examples of, like, anytime we see a version of the home that we live on a show, and it's a little bit dark or fucked up or haunted feeling, like, yeah. that's a micro genre within this that I really love.
Agreed. It's super fun. And they, you know, they're heading out to Empaknor, and they talk a lot about the stakes of even going there, because it's an abandoned space station, but Cardassian policy is to leave booby traps behind when you leave an installation like this. And that is kind of tossed off near a Bolian enlisted man, like one of Chief O'Brien's engineers, presumably. And he goes into the airlock where a bunch of other engineers are, you know, gathering bags that they're going to be bringing aboard. And we realize that this is going to be a bit of a Lower Decks episode.
Didn't we just do crew evaluation reports?
Yeah. The transition is a little awkward. Like, they just sort of swing the camera over
yeah.
to...
It's the camera is following Chief O'Brien and Garrick, and then it finds this Bolian, and then it's more interested in him than it is in the two characters that we know.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple ways that you see this done on television, and one of them is like the dialogue handoff, where a character will talk to a Lower Decks person, and then you're with them until the end of a scene, and you transition away. But this is a camera version of that,
mm-hmm.
and that's why it sticks out a little bit.
I like that every single one of these characters had a Boston accent, though. When you're replacing the plasma manifold on an aging Cardassian space station, it's not easy to find those parts new in box on the shelves of your local hardware store. That's why we're going to a similar space station in another part of town.
God, I definitely know the answer to this question, Ben, but have you ever been to a scrapyard?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like where they keep old cars where you can pick and pull?
I've never done the car kind, but my father was a contractor and became an architect and is a very handy guy and very very interested in woodworking and stuff. So when I was a kid, there were lots and lots of trips to architectural salvage yards.
Cool.
And you know, places where you could find, like, oh yeah, we have like 25 banister pieces from a Victorian house in San Francisco.
Cool.
That we like saved when they were knocking the house down.
It just blew my little kid mind to go to a place where you could sit inside 30 wrecked cars, you know, while my dad looked for a window crank to replace the one that he had, you know. That's just a fun day out.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the vibe you get from this episode. Like, they don't make these parts. You have to go get one.
You can't replicate them. There's something about the molecular structure of the parts that is impossible to replicate. So they make like a big list, right? Like there's a list of stuff they definitely need to get, stuff they'd like to get, and then stuff that would be cool to have if they can find it.
I like the implied we need to get value for the mission-ness of that moment, you know? Like,
right.
While we're here and we have all these people, like, let's not just get plan A. Let's get some backup stuff, too.
I don't necessarily love the way they divide that work up, though, because there's like two people on plan A, two people on plan B, two people on plan C.
Yeah. They shouldn't have equal labor associated, right?
Yeah. Or they should be like, all right, let's do plan A and B, and then if we have time, we'll do plan C or something like that.
There are a lot of characters in this episode. It feels very dense that way. You get your mains with O'Brien and Garrick, and right away, there's a tension between them over the whole Setlick 3 situation.
Yeah. O'Brien is sort of, maybe is considered by the Cardassians to be kind of a butcher.
This idea of O'Brien being the hero of Setlick 3 was a thing that was discussed during TNG. You remember that episode? I think it was The Wounded, when we got to meet O'Brien's former captain, Captain Maxwell. That was one of the great TNG episodes, that one with Maxwell and like singing war songs together and stuff. Like, O'Brien is sort of legendary in this way, and you only got a little glimpse of that in The Wounded, but you really get the sense that the Butcher of Setlick 3 is a rep that O'Brien bristles at a little bit, and it's something that Garrick really relishes in pressing that bruise.
Yeah. The terminology Garrick uses, of course, is the hero of Setlick 3, but... it seems like heroism earned in the process of ending the lives of a lot of Cardassian soldiers. And it comes up eventually in the episode that like O'Brien doesn't even know how many people he killed in that action.
It's something he probably has a lot in common with Worf with, right? Like Worf probably doesn't know either how many people he's just killed.
How many people have you like beamed over to their ship and just bat left?
Right. He like that's a fingers and toes situation for Worf.
and you try to avoid scenarios that provoke Worf to taking his shoes off.
Yeah.
Cuz gross.
Yeah. Yeah, you think you use a mechleth? Like what do Klingon personal hygiene utensils look like in the finger and toenail department?
Oh, man. Yeah. Klingon toe jam has got to be real serious shit.
Why in all of the Star Trek convention merchandise spaces we've been to has there never been a really rugged-looking toenail clipper that looks like two batlets? Do we have to come up with all this stuff?
Apparently. I mean, I know that our The Warrior, The Legends t-shirt is flying off the shelves over at MaxFunStore.com.
It's already sold out.
But it wasn't.
But yeah, I mean, do we now need to do a set of clippers, one for your beard and two for your pubes?
I'm ready to disrupt the science fiction personal grooming space. That's what
Do you think that it's like, it's considered weird to use the same set of clippers on your right pubes as it is on your left pubes?
That's just nasty, man. What the fuck?
Yeah, you sick
you
piece
sick
of
fuck.
Shit.
Maybe you get a little wild on one half, and in the other hemisphere, you keep it tight.
You do a little warrior scaping on one side. And
yeah.
Just let it go nuts on the other side.
Whatever mood you're in.
Yeah.
Gul Dukat.
So.
One thing that happens a bunch of times in this episode is we see a Cardassian sort of Mancala game getting played.
Mm-hmm.
And initially it is Garrick up against Nog, who is part of the mission. Nog comes aboard heavily armed with a crazy phaser rifle.
Phased plasma rifle in the 40-watt range.
But Nog and Garrick have a kind of an interesting conversation about the game, because Nog has this very like hyper-capitalist Ferengi approach to the way he plays a board game that Garrick says is like maladaptive to this game, because this is a Cardassian game, so it's all about like conquest and subjugation.
This is not a financial transaction.
And I thought that was a really fun way to... Like the games that we play and like the ideals that they espouse is such an interesting way to differentiate different species and different cultures.
Yeah, it really is. I like that touch. That game's going to come back again later. You just know it.
Yeah.
We get a lot of fun exterior shots of M'Pak Nor, and one of them is here as the runabout approaches. They can't just beam aboard because of the booby traps, and they can't just find a pylon to land on. Like they can't do this conventionally, so they need to creep up to an upper pylon in order to board the station. And every time we see the exterior, the station is a tilt. But there's one element to this shot that I really like that I feel like we don't get too often on Deep Space Nine, which is a parallaxing pan shot. And I think it is the one way you can really get a sense for the differences in size between the runabout and a station like this. Like,
yeah,
when you're just locked off looking at a runabout zoom by and the station in the background, you don't really get it. But that parallax effect, I think, really sells how differently sized the two things are, and it makes the station look huge.
Yeah, it's a shot that I wish we'd gotten in season one, episode one.
Right.
Because you finally get to see, like, relative size in a three-dimension, you get a three-dimensional sense of it because of the way the camera moves.
Right.
And yeah, like, they really do a nice job of making sure every time you see the station, the camera's at an angle or the station is at an angle, which is, like, I think it's something that the J.J. Abrams Star Trek film played with to great effect, and it is played with to great effect in this episode. Just making you feel ill at ease by showing the fact that vertical is kind of an idea that only exists on a planet.
Even the very name is racist.
And I also loved seeing Garak in a spacesuit. Get people in spacesuits more often, Star Trek. It's great.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, between the spacesuit and the phaser rifle that Nog is carrying, you get the sense that they kind of raided the Star Trek First Contact props room, right?
Totally, yeah.
It's nice. It's good to see that stuff get reused. It's too good to just languish in storage.
The concern here, and it is attendant to the fact that this is probably the episode of Star Trek that uses the word booby more than any other, is that the station is probably full of traps, and they're probably cued to non-Cardassian DNA, so that's why Garak is the one to go aboard and, like, turn on all the lights and turn the gravity back on and everything.
It's a fun moment of a dead thing coming to life, and yeah, the station isn't the only thing, because as soon as we cut to the exterior, as the lights are coming on, we find ourselves inside the infirmary, where a row of stasis pods has also come to life, and a few of whom have living Cardassian inhabitants.
God, this camera move is so cool, because it goes from a very wide shot showing all three pods to, like, an ECU on the eye of one of them opening up.
Yeah.
And it's not a Steadicam shot. It's like a handheld camera move, which, you know, like, they really lean on handheld in this episode because it makes you feel so ill at ease.
Right.
And it's really great. It is such a creepy shot. And they really nail the focus and the framing and everything.
It's really great. We should mention that this episode is directed by Mike Vahar, and the story is by Brian Fuller. And Mike Vahar has a interesting reputation on Deep Space Nine as kind of a tryhard. Like, he was known as the guy who always ran long and, like, kept people on set extra long, like, all of his shooting days were like that. And he acquired the nickname V Harder and V Harder for his willingness to put in long hour shooting, which everyone else involved with the show having to stay on set along with him. So not a great reputation, but he directed 9 episodes of DS9 and the coming of age episode of TNG.
Wow. 9 is kind of the magic number, right?
Kind of is.
Yeah, it is. It's the magic number.
So they have to be super careful moving around this station. Like, the rules are, like, make sure you scan every area before you move into it. And like, just tread super lightly, because we have no idea what we're in for. And sort of a haunted house episode. Like, one of the upshots of the way they're getting the A, B, and C list of equipment is we're all splitting up, and that's always a bad move in a horror film.
You do get Stoltzoff and Nog having sex later on. And that's
Yeah, well, they're punished for their teen love.
Right. I mean, and you're happy for Nog initially. You're like, yeah, finally. Like,
yeah,
that's
Nog
great.
Can get it.
Yeah, but then he's killed in horror movie fashion.
Yeah.
The split up's fun. It adds to, I mean, it's big station, little people. Like, that's one of the other stresses you feel. Like, everything's dark. You're just with one or two people at a time. And you never quite feel safe no matter who you're with. Like, very intentionally, O'Brien is pairing engineers with security officers. So the intent is to make them feel all right. But no one ever feels that way.
Yeah. Somebody that's going to know how to loosen all the bolts and get the right thing. And then somebody to watch that person's back. But, like, some people get paired with Garrick, for example.
Right.
And Garrick very quickly stumbles across Goo, which is, he's probably the worst possible person to stumble across this goo, as we will come to find out.
The shot is one of the first times that I really feel like the episode's director was inspired by Aliens. There's that close-up to a hand recoiling from a handrail, and there's that biogenic compound on it, and you just know it's going to be bad news.
Yeah, Garrick's got LV-426 problems, but a xenomorph ain't one.
Mm. It's a mouthful, but I like it.
I wished he would have been at greater pains to wipe this off himself.
It is impossible to wipe his hands off.
Yeah, he just keeps it on while the Bolian guy scans him, and then that's when they notice the infirmary with the stasis pods, and they find two of them are open and empty, but one of them has had a girder fall into it and break the glass. It's a brutal case of girder murder. Which is a phenomenon that happens from time to time in Star Trek.
Yeah, nothing more deadly than a girder in Star Trek, that's for sure.
It's fun to see a desiccated Cardassian, though. I loved the loaf being all like pulled taut against the skull.
It seems like space would be a place where you'd be most likely to find an old desiccated corpse of any kind. And yet you rarely see them in Star Trek. You see a recent phaser blasted person or bones, but rarely do you get the middle ground.
Adam, you know where you see a lot of them, though, is the TNG episode Booby Trap.
Yep.
Which is the other episode that's in contention for most utterances of the word booby.
You're right.
What the hell?
Which episode do you think has more of the word booby in it? The TNG episode Booby Trap or the DS9 episode Empok Nor? I'm going to find out right now.
God. Is it chickening out to guess that they have the same number of utterances?
No, I mean, push is something that you could bet.
I love that you know that. I would never know that.
Okay, I called up Booby Trap. Let me get the other one going. All right, Ben. I have tallied the votes. The results are in.
And the guy from PricewaterhouseCoopers is handing you the envelope.
Would you believe that the TNG episode Booby Trap has 5 utterances of the word booby? The DS9 episode Empok Nor has 5 utterances of the word booby. You are the winner, Ben.
USA! USA! USA!
Wow. I was not expecting that. But, I mean, clearly, 2 of the top booby episodes in all of Star Trek.
Yeah, and telling about us that we are as conscientious of that as we are.
What are you doing now?
Nog and O'Brien are continuing on team must have in doing their work on the station elsewhere, and unfortunately Nog has left a tool on board the runabout that he has to go back to. So he scampers on back to where it is docked, and it is not where they left it. It is, in fact, spinning in space, and then a moment later explodes in space.
Yeah. I loved the use of a lighting effect and reflection in the window.
Yeah.
When he watches this, because, you know, the camera cuts to, like, outside the space door in the upper pylon, and you see the reflection of the runabout exploding in the window.
I wonder how many runs at this they gave Aaron Eisenberg, because I really like the choice in his reaction here. But Nog as a character can be very screamy and panicky. And this is the change that being a cadet has made in him. Like, I think pre-Starfleet cadet Nog would have screamed in this mm-hmm. moment, but something has hardened in him.
And I think that that's a real credit to Aaron Eisenberg's choices as an actor. Like, he's really made major changes in how he plays the character
yeah.
to follow the character's story arc.
Right. This is a really bad moment because, like in a lot of horror films, you don't want your car to break down on the dark road. You don't want to be stranded.
Yeah.
And this is what has happened.
Yeah. And so that everybody gets together, and this is kind of when all of the bad news gets to everyone. It's, we don't have an RV to get home in, and also there's two murdering Cardassians wandering around the station. And as they're talking about this, they also discover that all of their equipment has gone dead. There's some kind of damping field.
The phone lines have been cut.
Yeah.
To continue the metaphor.
To continue the homage to Aliens.
Now what the fuck are we supposed to do?
Right.
It's, yeah. It's like exactly the same problem as we need to figure out a way to get in touch with the mothership. And that means all of our plans have been sidelined while we deal with that.
It's a pretty fun problem for an engineer to solve, though, because they are in this scrapyard. They have everything they need to solve the problem in kind of a MacGyver kind of way.
Yeah.
And so O'Brien redistributes his crew to tasks that have to do with gathering supplies in order to turn the station into kind of a giant telegraph machine.
Right. This is a good plan, except for it has the effect, again, of splitting everybody up.
Right.
And so in fairly short order, these Cardassian guards who have been left behind to guard the station start taking out crewmen.
Yeah, and it's Stoltzoff and Perchetti that go first, and they go almost exactly like the first two in Aliens do. Like, one is pulled through a wall, one is thrown over a balcony. Like, I think that's, they are the Frost and Crow of this episode.
Yeah.
That can't be an accident, right?
No, this is the Aliens episode of Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. It's super fun, and even the music sting, you were mentioning the music earlier, like, that kind of cascade orchestration of what music sounds like during a jump scare definitely happens here.
And super scary, like, the use of light and shadow and positioning the camera so that it's like looking through material. Like, there's a great shot where the guy is like pulling a circuit board or something out of something, and you see the door up on the second level of the promenade.
Yeah.
And it like closes as he pulls the thing out. Like, there's so many moments where the composition of the shot is just like perfect to really like peg your fear needle.
Yeah, it's super effective. The lighting on the station, not just atmospherically, but how characters are lit, really evokes this feeling of Aliens too. It's so much rim light and not a lot of key.
Low key lighting all the way through.
Yeah, it feels contextually understandable because of Aliens, you know? Like, you know what this is supposed to feel like because you've seen it before, but it's not a ripoff.
Yeah, it's homage. And
yeah.
And like, and I think that that's crucial, right? Like, it's not the story of Aliens with Deep Space Nine characters mapped onto it. It's very much its own story. Like, and I really like, you know, like, there's the one guy who's like really interested in collecting like memorabilia.
Uh-huh.
Like, he's a throwaway character that dies early in the episode, but he feels like super three-dimensional just because he has like a weird interest in that, and there are two or three mentions of it. Like, you feel those deaths a lot more because of things like that.
Yeah, just a little personal information about each one is all you need.
They find this guy and Stoltzoff, the one lady engineer, have bought it. This is about when we start to see Garrick, like, kind of going for itchy scratches on his neck periodically. Slightly subtler than, like, coughing up a little hanky full of blood, but starting to pepper in the idea that Garrick is not well.
Right.
I don't intend to stand around waiting to be killed.
I think what's interesting about this is that there are subtle physical changes to Garrick, but his attitude doesn't really feel that much different from how he was on the runabout. He's still goading O'Brien about what he did at Setlick 3.
Right.
He's wondering how much O'Brien may relish the chance to kill Cardassians again.
You know, he's in a great deal of danger at this point, right? Because, like, at least Amaro among the crew seems to have a very itchy trigger finger. And Garrick is goading O'Brien to the point of almost, like, challenging him to do something about the enmity he feels toward Cardassians. But O'Brien, to his credit, keeps a cool head and is, like, very focused on solving the problem of being out of communication without a car to get home.
O'Brien does that thing when you've got an employee you can't really control, and that's Garrick, right? Garrick doesn't want to be a part of the team. He wants to go off on his own to kill the soldiers himself. And O'Brien sort of pivots his rebellion into something he can use, you know?
Yeah.
Like, he sort of plays it out in the moment, like, well, someone's got to be on Cardassian duty, and it might as well be Garrick. So go ahead and kill the Cardies.
Right.
And he does effectively, because we almost immediately cut to Garrick's trap that he's laid for one of the soldiers. He's in the infirmary, and he's, like, loudly tapping on a computer, getting attention.
Access denied. Access denied.
Being the jangly keys that attracts this Cardassian soldier. And he hides in one of these stasis chambers and pops out and gets the jump on the guy and kills him.
He hides in the broken stasis chamber, crucially, which means he had to move all those creepy bones.
You think he did?
Yeah.
You didn't think he just got on top?
No, I think he had to move those bones to get in there.
Guess so.
Tom Morga plays one of these evil Cardassians.
Yeah? Tom Morga, we should say, a famous Jason.
one of the most famous Jasons.
One of the best Jasons. I thought he looked familiar.
Yeah. Yeah, and Garrick really enjoys doing this murder. We get a little scene in one of the cargo bays where Nog is asking Chief, like, what gives with all this Setlick 3 stuff? Like, why does that keep coming up? What did you do there? You know, the Chief is very circumspect about it. He's like,
why does Garrick keep bringing up Setlick 3?
The phaser was set at maximum. The man just incinerated there before my eyes.
I was a soldier, Nog. Sometimes soldiers have to kill.
And Garrick, like, comes back in crowing about the Cardassian he's killed, gives the Chief the emblem from the Cardassian so that he can give it to... I guess Pichetti is dead at this point, right? So it's just, like, in honor of Pichetti that he gives it to him?
I think this moment serves to evoke the grief over Pichetti's death.
Like, yeah.
Like, boy, wouldn't it be nice if you were alive? Because this
he
would
have loved
perfect.
This.
Yeah, it's that kind of feeling.
It's sort of like the Jewish soldier in a World War II film taking home a Luger that he took off of a Nazi officer or whatever,
or a scalp.
Yeah, in a bad World War II film, for example.
But Garrick wasn't just in the infirmary killing people and moving bodies around.
He also got information.
Yeah, he did some science in there. He found that psychotropic drugs were in the dead soldier's body, and they were given to him in order to amplify a Cardassian's already there xenophobic feelings.
Yeah, he was high as hell on racism drugs.
It's a xenophobe amplifier.
So they gave them a drug to make them hate anybody but Cardassians. Maybe it's an experiment that went wrong.
And I think anybody that has watched Garak scratch his neck two times already in this episode can do the math on Garak has been dosed with this.
Garak's like, I found a prescription bottle in his tunic. He had a bottle full of 4chan. I've never heard of it.
I probably shouldn't have eaten that booger I found on that railing.
Yeah, and so now we're starting to understand that it's not just a neck scratch and sweats for Garak, that his exposure to whatever it is on the station is probably going to result in some violent consequences for everyone else. Because I don't know if you've noticed, Garak is the only Cardassian in this crew, so their ability to get along is going to be diminished.
Morn.
Dear sweet Morn.
Morn.
Evening, everybody.
Morn.
Stop. Hammer time.
And in very short order, the remaining Cardassian soldier kills Bokta, and then Garak kills the Cardassian soldier and Amaro, the last of O'Brien's crew. So we're left with Garak, Nog, and O'Brien being the only people alive on the station. And O'Brien, like, finds Amaro just in time for Amaro to, like, with his last breath, tell him who did the deed. Garak has gone full racist.
It's a shock when Garak stabs Amaro with the flux coupler, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, you see it coming, and it is still just, like, super dirty feeling.
Yeah.
And so now it's kind of a O'Brien and Nog need to find and eliminate Garak kind of a deal, and they get a radio communication from him. He's up on the command deck in the old station commander's office, and he's found a game of Cardassian Mancala that he would like the chief to come play with him.
You often get, like, the climax of a conflict in television being, like, you know, protagonist, antagonist, finally reaching the same location and having their fight. And what's so interesting about what O'Brien is going through is that he's resisting the thing in him that is the Cardassian killer.
Right.
Like, he knows Garak. He doesn't want to do it. A part of him wants to save him. A part of him resents that Garak believes him to be a thing that he isn't. And yet a part of him knows that, like, he may have to kill a guy and become what Garak is calling him.
Yeah, is super uncomfortable with that. Mainly probably because he doesn't want to have to, like, look Bashir in the eye and tell him what he did.
Is there a action figure of Setlik 3 O'Brien, which is, like, just the Ramboed out Miles O'Brien?
Would love to see that.
Do you think Keiko ever calls him Setlik 3 O'Brien?
They do, like, some kind of, like, sexy costume play where she's like, tonight I want the hero of Setlik 3 to come home and take me.
She grabs a spoon from the play setting and, like, sticks it up to her forehead. I want you to really ravage me, Miles.
Give it to me like you gave it to all those soldiers you killed. Jesus. Come on, Keiko.
I want you to murder this fucking puss, Miles. The reality is Keiko wishes she could get Setlik 3 a little more often than her birthday.
Yeah. So they head up to Ops, and this is a classic Garak trap.
Yep.
You know, they, you get O'Brien up in the commander's office, knocked down in the huddle area in the center of the room, and the door slams shut, and there's a force field, and then Nog gets taken hostage by crazed racist Garak.
I think they did Nog wrong here by wrapping him up like a damsel in distress put on railroad tracks.
Tied to a railroad track. Yeah.
Like, I couldn't get that image out of my mind. Like, the way that he's binded up evokes only that for me.
Don't do it, Chief.
I really do like Garak toward the end of this episode. He gets super Schmeagle with his line reads. And moody, and I don't know. I just love it.
He's totally crazed. They like, definitely hit him with the mister every time they get him on camera. He's, like, drenched in sweat. And so they have to make, like, an agreement. Like, we're going to meet it down on the promenade. No weapons. Let's talk this out. So we get O'Brien kind of, like, lurking on the promenade, you know, running around with his gun. I feel like you got to turn the headlight off on your gun if you're trying to be sneaking around with a rifle guy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
And not looking good.
O'Brien continues to negotiate. He's all right with meeting him without weapons on the promenade, and so they do. And the funny part is that they both arrive with weapons. Like, neither of them are willing to trust the other, which is great.
Yeah, very, very realistic, I think.
Yeah. So they finally do drop their weapons and go hand to hand here. And the dark covers up the stuntmen cutting nicely. I thought this sequence cut together real nice.
I agree. It was a fun Star Trek fight.
Yeah.
Kind of like Tiger Claw combat style.
I like that quite a bit, yeah. Cardassians are so scaly, I can't believe that punching one would really do all that much.
I wonder if you could like peel one of their scales to really hurt them.
Yeah, I would like to see that.
Go, yeah, like really claw at him, O'Brien. Like turn your hand around and claw outward to see if you can like separate some of those neck scales.
O'Brien uses the power of engineering and not his fists to subdue Garrick, because when he put his weapons down, he put a phaser on top of his tricorder, and then when he was thrown free from the melee, he taps his communicator badge, and it triggers this improvised explosive that
he's got a great action movie quotable.
Yeah.
Maybe you're not a soldier anymore.
You're right. I'm an engineer.
It would have been great if, like, we cut from Garrick to O'Brien, he triggers the thing, back to the explosion, and it's just like a red mist.
Garrick's not on the show anymore, boys.
That blew way big.
Yeah, so the chief goes and unties Nog, and then, you know, they look down at Garrick, and Garrick is moaning, so we know he's not totally dead, but he has been taken off the board as a threat. And then we cut back to Deep Space Nine, and we know it's Deep Space Nine because it's like the light is a little warmer and the station is not at a weird angle.
Yeah, it's funny how that's all the context you need.
It's amazing.
You can
it's
do
really
it
well done.
With light and angle. That's
like
it.
The like visual language of this show is so detailed and rich that they literally like one establishing shot and there's no question in your mind where this is setting up the scene.
You know what safety feels like and you know what danger feels like based on those two things.
They're in the infirmary and Bashir is kind of getting Garrick back to health. He's sort of detoxing on his racism drug. And Bashir is at great pains to say like anybody would have done what Garrick did when exposed to a drug like this. Like this, he was not in control of his actions. So the two murders he did are going to be hard to blame on him. But nevertheless, there's going to be an inquest, and Garrick is going to have to answer for this in some way.
Based on the show's track record, maybe he will, maybe he won't. But really awkward moment when Garrick asks O'Brien to talk to Amuro's widow for him, you know, knowing correctly that she's not going to want to talk to him.
Oh, yeah, I guess Garrick only really killed one person.
But I think you could make the case that he was responsible for Bakhtar's death. He sort of allowed it to happen.
Yeah, he could have killed that other guy quicker and not allowed Bakhtar's neck to be broken.
Yeah, Bakhtar went out ugly. With that, yeah. Like, mini garage door going down on his head.
Yeah. It's like no he was good. Trying to follow Spock's Mark IV torpedo tube out into space.
It just takes his head out there.
If he'd been any closer to O'Brien's little improvised explosive device, it would have killed him, but he just has a couple of broken ribs and a rung bell.
Yeah, it's kind of a reverse slide whistle at the end, right? Like, that realization that, yeah, he was trying to kill him. He just didn't.
Yeah.
So Garrick was right, kind of.
Kind of.
You really want to do this? Here, now, okay, let's do it, do it!
Did you like the episode?
I really did. I this is a weird day for me because I had, like, a bunch of medical stuff I had to go do. So I wound up taking this episode on an iPad to the library and watching it at the library mostly, and then watching like the last 10 minutes in the waiting room at my doctor's office.
But does that make you the weirdo at the library? Like, are the porn watching hobos the ones moving away from you?
They saw me masturbating to Deep Space Nine, and they definitely moved to the other side of the computer area.
That guy's a real creep.
Something wrong with him.
Wow. Yeah. Did it change your feelings about the show to take it in a different environment?
I mean, I think that what struck me about it was this is a very like atmospheric episode, very creepy episode, and yeah. I felt like it was effective despite the fact that I wasn't in like a dark TV watching room with, you know, like it was far from an ideal viewing experience, and yet it was still very effective, and I really liked it.
That's kind of a great litmus test for something like this. Like,
yeah.
It's sort of like the thing with comedy that we talk about a lot, which is like, if you laugh and you're by yourself, I think that's effective comedy. But if you're scared watching a thing, but you're also in public, that's a check in the four column for intensity and horror.
Definitely.
That's
good. How about you? Did you like the episode?
I really did, but it does suffer from the where is the little D problem that I think so often pokes a hole in an episode story. Like, you have to believe that there's no other way to communicate with Deep Space Nine once you're stuck on this other station.
Yeah.
You have to rationalize the idea that even though they're in a dangerous place, the Defiant isn't going to go. Like, they're going to stuff a runabout full of all these people. But I was able to suspend that thinking, and I enjoyed the episode for being able to do it.
Agreed.
One thing that we cannot suspend is our program of Priority One messages, because they're the thing that keeps the show going. You want to check out our inbox?
Nah, let's not do it this time.
All right.
No, I'm just kidding. Let's do it.
All right. You really had me going there.
Priority One message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Need a supplemental income.
Supplemental income?
Supplemental. Yeah, it's extra.
By the interest alone, could be enough to buy this ship.
Adam, we have a couple of Priority One messages here. The first one is from Assistant Chief Engineer Christmas Tequila Shimoda.
That sounds like a James Bond name.
It's to Ben and Adam. It goes like this. I know you like P1 questions, so I have two-ish. One, Adam, did you ever watch MacGruber with your wife?
No, and it's been something I've been wanting to do forever. Ben, I'm sure you have this problem. I hesitate to call it a problem, but this challenge also, which is like you want to share something you love so much with your special person, and you just know that that's not going to go well. And so there really isn't a good time to present that and do that. And so I've been unable to make that happen.
I have an idea. How about this? You're going to be in LA with your wife pretty soon. What about an evening where you and your wife and me and my wife order a pizza and make some cocktails or something, and we watch MacGruber together?
That sounds great.
That's a fun group activity.
I love it. I love it. Let's do it.
He didn't.
The second question, do you think a lot of Starfleet Academy is just programming your brain to be able to speed read science? Elkar's and Miles's wands seem to display a lot of information very quickly. Is any 40-year-old ensign to us like Khan is to Starfleet? Oh, interesting. So the question is basically like, are they such brilliant geniuses? Like would they be such brilliant geniuses compared to us that they would be like Khan is to a Starfleet?
Oh, interesting. I wonder to what extent Starfleet Academy is learning to learn in the way that, you know, so often school can be right now. Like, like you learn tricks with how to do math formulas that are like shortcuts, and there are some like reading techniques where you can like just look at a page of text and memorize it. And
get the gestalt of it.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of Starfleet Academy just might be that, knowing that information's going to be coming at you so fast.
Right. Because, like, you don't actually have to know that much. It's like you have to know how to get at what you need to know to solve a given problem.
And to share that thing that you know with people who can make decisions about how to address it.
Yeah, like, they live in the hyper-Googleized future, right? Where, like, you don't need to remember anyone's phone number to tap your communicator badge and be in immediate contact with them.
Yeah.
Like, the number of facts you need to retain walking around is actually pretty low, but your ability to get to facts quickly has to be very high.
I was just thinking about how we never saw the scene of O'Brien rigging his phaser and tricorder bomb combo, and how what if that were just always a thing that would happen if you tapped your communicator and your phaser and your tricorder were next to each other? Like, you have to make very sure when you put them on your belt that they are on opposite sides of your waist. Otherwise, you go boom.
Fun.
Ben, our second priority one message is from Josh and is for Carl. And the message goes like this. Hey, Carl 226. It's been a blast working on actual ion drives with you.
Whoa.
Here's hoping our little engines make it to the moon. I'm going to miss always doing bits. Literal and figurative, may your bit moments be few and far between. Wow, yeah. Sounds like we got a couple of rocket scientists here.
Some kind of brilliant geniuses of science and engineering.
I would like to know more about that.
Indeed. I went to a warehouse office space in Seattle one time where they were developing a fusion propulsion system for NASA. And it was like one of the coolest things I ever got to do. The guy was like, yeah, this is a fusion rocket engine. No big deal.
Yeah, this is my garage.
Yeah. But he had like a real NASA grant. He was like a UW professor. Fucking nuts.
Well, I love a question P1, and I love a P1 from a couple of real life rocket scientists. So that's cool to hear from Carl and Josh.
It sure is. If you'd like to leave a P1 of any kind, you can do that by going to MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. It's $100 for a personal message and $200 for a promotional message, and we really appreciate everyone who does that because it helps us cover the costs of making this show. Hey, Adam!
What's that, Ben?
Did you find yourself a drunk Shimoda?
Incredible!
Drunk Shimoda!
Yeah, I think I'm going to go outside the show and assign my Shimoda to Andrew Robinson. He's so great in this episode, and the little bit of reading I did about it revealed some reluctance on his part to play Garrick in this way. Andrew Robinson was the psycho in the Dirty Harry movie.
I've changed my mind. I'm going to let her die.
Like, that's sort of his claim to fame as an actor. And he had thought that he had put that kind of role behind him. It's one of the reasons he enjoyed playing Garrick so much. And so when he got the script initially, he was not that into it, but I think you and I agree after watching his performance, pretty incredible work by Andrew Robinson. And I hope, like, the Shimoda is about having the most fun. I hope it was at least a little bit of fun for him to do this, because I really enjoyed his performance quite a bit.
I did too. I wonder, as an actor, how much power you have in a situation like that. If you're like a series regular, but not in the main cast on a show, and they send you a script and say, hey, we're going to need you for these dates, and you really don't want to do that script.
Yeah.
They can't force you to do it, right?
There's kind of a rocky road to this episode being made. They went through a bunch of script versions, and the early ones were not great. And several of the actors came out and said, you know, if we had to do those first couple of drafts, it really would have been a dog of an episode.
Wow.
It really makes you think about how many of those stories an actor has of, like, the near misses for a beloved character that they somehow found a way to avoid in this way. For every Empok Nor, there is the version of that episode that is potentially very bad and could damage how we feel about a character forever. So,
yeah, seriously. Well, I think, whatever happened behind the scenes to get the script into shape worked. Yeah.
What about you, Ben?
My drunk Shimoda is Nog, and it's for the moment when Garrick gets the drop on him, because Nog has that big crazy phaser rifle, which Garrick takes off of his hands. But Nog still has the hand phaser in his belt, visibly, when that happens, and I just thought he was going to like reach down for it and like drop to the floor and stun Garrick, you know? Like, it would have been the easiest thing in the world, like a very low-risk move.
Yeah.
And he didn't do it. So Nog is my drunk Shimoda.
The Nog you get in this episode is the brave in the face of death Nog, but he's never resistant to his situation. And it made me wonder, when you see that phaser on his belt, like if there was a moment that was cut from the episode that went like, I know Garrick and I like Garrick, I can't draw my weapon on him, even though he's clearly in the sway of this psychotropic drug, you know?
Right. Yeah.
You're just left to infer that. But yeah, that's an interesting bit. I mean, you may even call it a mistake. Like, I don't know why they'd leave a phaser on him.
I don't know either.
That it is.
But he's my drunk Shimoda.
Gotta get that gold press lacquer. Get that
gold press lacquer.
Am I right?
Well, no mistakes around here for you and me as we think about what episode we're going to watch next. And the way we're going to watch it is dictated to us by the Game of Buttholes. Will of the Prophets.
Yeah, our next episode is Season 5, Episode 25, In the Cards. Jake and Nog risk an intergalactic incident in an innocent quest to lift Sisko's spirits. An intergalactic incident? Like another, like aliens from another galaxy are characters in this episode? Is that what this is saying?
Sounds like the stakes are pretty high.
Fuck.
But will the stakes for us be high, Ben?
You're required to learn as you play. Roll.
We're currently on square 35. One square ahead is a Kanar with Damar episode. And that, I believe, is the only thing in range for our little runabout.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and roll this bone, Adam. I hope I don't channel you and roll a Kanar with Damar. But I have not channeled you. I rolled a 5.
Chula!
Did I win?
Hardly.
And I've jumped us all the way to square 40.
Wow. Well, moving right along.
Now in range of a Coco Nono, I believe.
Oh, I like that.
Don't mind a nice Coco Nono from time to time.
Sure don't. Also, don't mind the great support we get from our viewers, those that go to MaximumFun.org/donate are the ones that help keep this show going month to month.
Sure are. We also got to thank our buddy Adam Ragusea, who makes original theme music for the program, based on the original theme music by Dark Materia. And Adam Ragusea, now a big-time YouTube celebrity, cooking all kinds of delicious, easy recipes for the home cook on his Adam Ragusea cooking channel. Just search for his name on YouTube. You'll find it.
Want to give a right on to Bill Tilly. He's at Bill Tilly 1973 on Twitter. He is the creator of the trading cards based on our show. He is right now creating cards for Star Trek Discovery. And one thing you can't do around Bill Tilly is just mention something offhand, because he will just go and do the thing, which is what he's done in going back and making cards for season one at this point of Star Trek Discovery. And it is a trip to go back and think about those episodes now, a couple years old.
Amazing that we said anything that I think is funny, but apparently we did, because I saw some funny stuff on those cards.
Yeah, fun to go back and re-experience that. Good job, Bill Tilly.
A+. We don't deserve you. I always say that. Thank you to everyone who donates, and also to everyone who goes on Apple Podcasts or whatever their podcatcher is and recommends the show using whatever tools they make available on there. That really helps us out.
Yeah, if you're not going to support the show month to month, find someone who will.
Yeah, recommend it to a friend, family member, or a stranger on the internet.
With that, we'll be back at you next time with another great episode of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, and an episode of The Greatest Generation Deep Space Nine that tries to remember who Jake Sisko is.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.